Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you two, not in a creepy way.
Welcome, this is brother Jay. And tonight, we are going to talk about the 2012 film Argo.
Yeah, we are.
So as a little background, let's start with brother Drew. When was the first time you saw this movie?
I saw it when it first came out on video. I did not see it in the theater, but I was aware that it had gotten, tremendous reviews. It had done well at the Oscars and other awards. So I was certainly interested in seeing it. And, yeah. I watched it once back then, and then I haven't seen it again since we watched it to discuss it today. How about you?
I equally did not see this in the movie theater, but that's because as I rolled into my middle adult agedness, I don't tend to go to movies because I hate people. So I bought a used copy of this when it came out. For like $3 at a resale CD DVD resale store that I frequent. I used to frequent quite a bit, but now there isn't a lot of market for CDs and DVDs, so it's hard to find resales. But I digress. I bought a copy of it and watched it, and I was amazed by it. And so I've actually watched it a few times. And then boyfriend Jesse and I watched it last night, so in preparation for tonight.
Yeah, it turns out Ben Affleck is a decent director.
Yeah, we'll skip to the end. Boyfriend Jesse actually said, this movie makes me really start to like Ben Affleck.
Yeah, I mean, he's a bona fide movie star.
Yeah, so... I guess let's jump into the plot. We'll go with the plot supplied by Wikipedia, which sometimes right. The movie takes place beginning in November of 1979 when Iranian, I don't want to call them extremists, but I guess some of the Islamic class stormed the U.S. embassy in Tehran after... Jimmy Carter gave the Shah asylum when he fled Iran. So that resulted in about 60 of the embassy staff being taken hostage. But six of them, in an attempt to avoid capture, escape from the embassy and end up in the home of the Canadian ambassador, Ken Taylor. And they are secreted away, and the State Department starts looking at ways to exfiltrate them. And so that's the origin of this movie.
Now, were you old enough to follow this on the news when this happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I wasn't because I don't remember it.
I remember it because at one point we were living in California. Mm-hmm. Because of the Carter oil debacle, the embargo, and when we moved into the facility, the condo compound, I think it was a company compound, if I recall.
An oil company.
Yeah. I don't think it was an entirely oil company, but I think the oil company had procured several condos for workers to keep them kind of together. And I suspect the market was a little expensive because it was the Bay-ish area.
Yeah, it was right outside of San Francisco, right?
Yeah. Larkspur Landing in San Marin. So our neighbors, quote unquote neighbors, had a son, and Eric, I think his name was Amir. And Eric and Amir, I think, became friendly. And it turned out we kind of met the parents and met the family, and they had fled when the Shah fled, and they were really just waiting for the Shah to come back into power so they could return home. And so that was a thing, because that really didn't happen. And so I think they ended up having a much lengthier stay in the United States than they had anticipated. But I remember California, and that the atmosphere was very different, and dad taking work, and it was a very strange kind of fractious time. So, but I do remember the news and the hostage crisis, because that's when Nightline was started as a hostage watch show, basically, with Ted Koppel. And as anybody who knows me knows, I not much unlike Brother E, was an avid news junkie as a kid. I don't know why, but for some reason, I just gravitated towards the news. I think because it was always changing, and I had this drive to always want to be aware of what was going on. And I don't know where I get that from.
But well, it was also such a different time. You were exposed to media in so different ways than you are now. It was very compartmentalized. You only got news 3 times a day, and you got a half hour to an hour at a time. So there really was like a cycle.
And in Alaska, sometimes you didn't get news quickly at all.
Right.
So live news, I mean, the nightly broadcasts were a thing, because they were up until I think you were probably nearly in your teens. I think they still had tape delay TV.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I'm old enough to remember how revolutionary a concept CNN headline news was. Just like a 24 hour opportunity to get news anytime you want. But even that, it was just a half hour show that they repeated over and over again. So it wasn't like it was updated a lot, but that was the beginning.
It updated when things happened, but it was reliable otherwise, because it was always like sports on the 19s and weather on the 23s. And
yes,
there was something very comforting about that, because you knew you could like, oh, it's 19 minutes after the hour and it's sports. I can skip the news for these 3 minutes.
Yeah, but I remember when something major happened, news would break into, like daytime TV. But if it wasn't major news like that, it was not uncommon to actually like learn new bits of information by reading the paper the next day.
Yeah,
which is kind of a wild concept now.
It's very very antiquated now. Mm-hmm. Almost quaint, one would say. So,
yes.
So to wrap up your question, I do remember this, but I think this is in at least my memory, because the huge extreme shift from Alaska to California for me, mm-hmm. which I was miserable. So, I just didn't like California. It was hot all the time, and it was full of bugs I'd never seen before, and I almost drowned in a swimming pool. And, you had that unfortunate tomato soup incident.
Yes.
And, we had a crazy babysitter. And what else was weird about California? Burned the hell out of myself on a black pleather car seat. After I think it was The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, I don't remember much about the condo, but also we moved from a pretty decent sized house with a big yard to a condo.
And I think it was, I don't think it was more than a 2-bedroom condo, because I'm pretty sure Eric and I shared a room, and I think you were in Mom and Dad's room. But I could be misremembering that.
Yeah.
I really don't know. But yeah, no, I remember being tiny, but I just remember it just being weird, because first of all, I got dark at night in the summer. but it stayed hot and it was just, it was pervasive. And I just, yeah. And then there was sales tax, which just confused me, because we would go to the grocery store to spend like this minimal allowance money, which, you know, at the time it was generous, of course, but for us, it was like we would go and spend our dollar and whatever, and I would go and buy something, and my dollar wasn't worth a dollar.
Yeah, the Anderson pastime of keeping mental track of what you're buying to the penny.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, sales tax, when you're not used to it, really feels insulting.
It hides the true cost of things. Mm-hmm. So. It's kind of deceptive in that way, I think. So I think you should have the price on it of what it really is. It's kind of like car companies that hide all these fees. Here's the sticker price, except then you have to pay all these stupid fees on top. Well, then the sticker price really isn't the price. So, but we've gone way afield. So in true Brother E fashion, let's come back around. So so I guess to put a point on your point. So I have a clear memory of the situation. I don't have a clear memory. Like, I don't have a memory at all of the six people. And I don't ever remember hearing the story. So I remember hostages taken. I remember when the hostages were recovered. But the six specifically, I don't remember anything about them at all. So,
yeah. Well, the true story wasn't declassified until, what, 97?
Right. That sounds about right.
It was Clinton that declassified it?
Yes.
I about 12 years ago, I read a book, I have it, called Guests of the Ayatollah, because I was interested in learning more about the hostage crisis, because it really had a profound impact on American history. I mean, it really ushered in Reagan as a president.
Yes.
So the Guests of the Ayatollah is a book written by Mark Bowden, the dude who also wrote Black Hawk Down. And it's, you can see it's quite thick and it's a dense read. There's lots of information.
I'd say it's about 5 inches thick, maybe.
It's a good 650 pages.
Excellent.
It was a really, really good book, really interesting, but it barely mentions the six. It focused mostly on, you know, the plight of the hostages in the embassy. So this is a really interesting story to kind of tack on to, you know, the other parts that I knew about.
So the movie shows the taking of the embassy, and that was really, I guess I would say, throughout this movie, after the third and fourth watch, I am tense every time I watch this movie, and I know how it ends, but there's just something about the cinematography and the music and the people, and it's so well acted and it is so well shot that it really feels like you are there.
Oh yeah, this is a great thriller that really keeps the tension on you for the entire movie. I mean, up until the very last scene.
Yeah. So the embassy gets taken. And the six escape, and they end up at the Canadian ambassador's house. And he takes them in generously, and he hides them nearly Anne Frank style, although not in the attic, but this time kind of their basement.
And there were some initial thoughts that this whole thing would blow over in a couple days.
Well, they themselves kind of had a debate over, like, oh, this'll end. This is just a thing. It'll blow over. It's no big deal. However, when they basically were like, no, the Shah's never coming back ever, except maybe in a coffin, then that escalated the tensions. And that's when we enter Tony Mendez, who is a CIA guy. He's actually a specialist, who specializes in specifically exfiltration. He is brought into a meeting where the CIA, was it the CIA?
No, it was a group of people. It was the State Department who was coming up with the first plan.
The State Department, which had a bicycle plan.
Yeah.
A bicycle escape plan, which he quickly eviscerates without without so much as a fuck given. He pretty much is just like, that is stupid. And this is why it's stupid. Pointing out that perhaps, you know, having them bike 300 miles in the wintertime, not a good idea. Also, they would never make it anyway. But he basically kind of gets dismissed by the group, even though, you know, he may have some expertise. And as he is on the phone with his son, he and his son are watching over the phone. They turn to the same television channel, which is kind of this quaint. They dial the television to the same channel, which is a kind of an anachronism. And they both end up watching Battle for the Planet of the Apes. And it pops into his head that this is how they will get people out. They will make a cover story by making a movie, making some kind of crazy science fiction movie.
This is such a bonkers concept.
It really is, but it's also so out of the box that it is not. I'm not amazed that it worked. I'm amazed that it worked as well as it did, but I'm not amazed that it worked. So he, Mendez, played by the capable Ben Affleck, he contacts John Chambers, who is a Hollywood makeup artist. By the way, if you look up John Chambers, holy crap, he has done a crap ton of stuff. Not to mention, we've seen much of his work in all of the original Planet of the Apes movies.
He's got an Oscar? I think he had some sort of like wild list of accolades that included an Oscar and like the highest civilian honor that the CIA would bestow.
So he won an honorary Oscar at the 41st Academy Awards.
Okay.
For his work on long before the, and so that was before they had established an award for best makeup. He also was the first motion picture makeup artist to receive a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. But he also worked on the pilot episode of Mission Impossible. He created Leonard Nimoy's Spock ears. His character creations include Cornelius and Dr. Zaius from Planet of the Apes series, which are on display at the Science Fiction Museum in Seattle, which is now going to have to go on my list of places to go to. But he has done a ton, I mean, just amazing stuff that we've seen and discussed before. The Island of Dr. Moreau, which I don't know if you've seen, 1977. Halloween 2, Blade Runner.
Nice.
And he's uncredited for Blade Runner, but he's also uncredited for National Lampoon Class Reunion, which I suspect is not a great loss. But amazingly, John Chambers, played by the also very capable John Goodman, decides that, you know, this is just stupid enough and dumb enough that this is what Hollywood would be like. So this movie has this long-running theme of they deliberately make fun of Hollywood and everybody around it because it is just stupid. And that this is a stupid idea, so of course it's Hollywood. Like, this is so Hollywood, it's Hollywood. So it would have to be a real thing. It could be a real thing, and they play it as if it were going to be a real thing. They are sincere in trying to get this thing made, even though they know it's not going to get made.
Oh, that's, yeah. I love the spycraft behind this exfiltration plan. They're not just going to establish fake identities for the six Americans and provide them, Canadian passports. They're actually going to put a movie into production so that if the Iranian government digs into the story, that it will have all the necessary background.
Yeah. So the plot, the movie, the entire process has legs. They've given it a foundation.
Yeah. I mean, they're getting stories written about it in the trades.
They bought space in the trades, and then they held a press conference. I mean, they had to procure a script.
They hired actors to do a reading of the screenplay in full costume as a media event.
It was painful to watch, by the way.
Oh, it was fun. Oh, and the movie itself sounds terrible.
It sounds like a bad mixture of like Dune and Star Wars.
Yeah.
It looked like a faded photocopied version of Star Wars, kind of.
I was wondering if it was a real thing or if Flash Gordon was actually the movie that the CIA made to get them out of the country.
I mean, this Argo as a movie sounded interesting. I mean, I don't know that it would be good, but it would be interesting to watch. I'm slightly interested to read the screenplay, but then again, I'm sure that it would not live anywhere up to my expectations. So,
oh, there is a lengthy Wikipedia article about the book that the screenplay was based on.
Interesting.
Well, the book is called Lord of Light.
So John Chambers and Tony Mendez now get in touch with Lester Siegel, played by Alan Arkin, who is great.
Yes.
I think this movie was really incredibly well cast. And Alan Arkin, the Lester Siegel, they're all in this. And as it turns out, we learn John Chambers has worked for the CIA for some time. This is not his first rodeo of exfiltration. He worked with the CIA for spy disguises. So this is what he does. You know, he likes this kind of stuff. He helps out. Mm-hmm. And Lester Siegel seems to be, for some reason, inexplicably ultra patriotic because he really wants to help get people out. But his connection is less clear. His motivation is less clear. And I think throughout the movie, it's hard to determine if he is doing this to atone for his perceived terribleness as a father or as some kind of repairing his karma, or I'm not sure what his motivation is. But to me, I never discerned what his motivation was. With John Chambers, you know what his motivation is. Like, he's getting paid. Somebody's paying him.
Yeah, it just seemed like Siegel was, he was down for the adventure to actually do something interesting.
Yeah. So Tony Mendez and Lester pal around Hollywood and they throw up a show and they get a script and they are flashy and they have convinced people this is a real thing and it's going to happen. And so the CIA and the State Department sign off on this plan. That this is a go. We're going to try it out. Or, you know, go. As tensions have started to escalate in Iran, it's decided that it's time to get them out. That the Canadian ambassador is getting a little nervous. The pressure is on. And it's time for the Americans to step up. Because the Canadians can't. They're just like, we can't keep doing this.
Yeah. One of the chilling through lines of this movie is even though the embassy workers shredded and burned tons of sensitive information, the faction that took over the embassy were having children sweatshop style put all the shredded documents, because they were not cross-cut, they were just single-cut, all the shredded paper back together like puzzle pieces. And some of the documents that had been shredded were the actual personnel files that included photographs of everybody who worked at the embassy. So that added a ticking clock element, because they were slowly piecing together the photos of everybody who worked there so that the Iranians would then know who they had and who was out there. And then they'd be able to identify them on site as Americans.
Which is nuts. I mean, if you have free labor, right?
Mm-hmm.
It makes me happy for my cross-cut shredder. but also the fact that they were trying so hard to get things out that they actually overran their incinerator, which just gave up.
Yeah.
Also makes you wonder why they didn't have a better procedure, though. that perhaps that was not the best scenario.
Yeah, complacency, hubris.
Yeah, but it was interesting it never occurred to me as they're breaking the visa plates that was a thing. I mean, I get it now, but it just was one of those things that I'm like, huh, I would have never even figured that was a thing. But
yeah,
I guess that's something you definitely don't want somebody to have access to. The project gets greenlighted. Anyway, they're a go for the program. So Tony enters Iran, and he doesn't seem thrilled or happy to be doing this. I got the impression that he didn't think, at least from Mr. Affleck's performance, it didn't seem like he thought that there was much success in this. And Bryan Cranston did a great job because he also doesn't do the soft sell to Tony. He uh-huh. is like, well, because they make the joke in the parting shot as Tony gets out of the car at the airport and says, you know, I figure I'll take some good books with me so I have some time to read. The Cranston character says, you know, yeah, like you'll have time to read. Like it won't kill you before that. So kind of that dose of reality, but with that black sense of humor, which is probably less humor and more just kind of nervous laughter because it's the truth.
Yeah. I didn't really read Mendez as like being pessimistic. I read him as being very matter of fact and with a practiced calm. Like he was good in tense situations. He was able to stay on an even keel, which was really necessary when he was with the six Americans, because they were not calm and they were terrified.
Well, rightly so. So Tony's in Iran and he goes to meet with, well, he gets some contact with the Iranian government trying to establish the premise of what he's trying to accomplish, which is they want to shoot a movie. They want a sci-fi picture. They want this Star Wars kind of style thing. And of course they have this, here's my storyboards and here's the script and here's our plan and here's what we'd like to do. And the minister kind of gives him some grief about, well, you know, we're here, you know, I'm here to make sure that there is a purity to what you're doing, which I think also translated into, you were going to have to give me some cash for me to consider this.
Yeah. And this is another piece of spycraft that I really love. He had, Mendez had no interest or even did he think he would get a permit to do the movie. But it was important to get it on record that he had tried, so that when they looked into it, you know, he'd laid the tracks.
He was going through all the steps that you would take if you were really trying to make a movie.
Mm-hmm. And they were so deliberate about it. It really provided a bedrock foundation for this espionage. It was great. I loved it.
So they've picked this exotic location in Iran. They're trying to get it made. Tony tries to make contact with several of the ministers and agents in the government to make a paper trail that he's definitely, absolutely, positively, no doubt making some kind of Argo movie. But the six guests and the Canadian residents are getting a little restless. But Tony shows up and starts talking to them, and Cran tries to get them on board with the plan. And some of them come on board very quickly. A couple of them are much more reticent to come around. And of course, there's one holdout who just absolutely refuses. Doesn't believe it. Thinks that it's crazy and stupid.
Is that Scoot McNary?
So Tony says, you know, I've never left anyone behind. And there is some tension around the fact that
I did not believe him, by the way.
You didn't believe
I didn't believe him that he had a 100% success rate.
Well, I think there was an asterisk to his 100% success rate. So there's always shades of the truth. But, you know, he's a CIA guy. He lies for a living. He obscures and obfuscates for a living. So you have to expect that it's not going to be completely honest. So there's some tension. He gives them their backstories and tells them, you have to learn these, and you have to learn them so that they are that you are them. You have to become these people. These are your new lives. And if you can convince yourself and you can be this person, you will convince the Iranian. You'll convince everyone on the outside. So go over it, go over it, go over it, go over it, go over it. And they're nervous and reluctant, but most of them come around and start working. And of course, they have amongst themselves, they have a little, you know, some arguments and tension about this is dangerous and this could, you know, cost us our lives. And the point is made, well, it would be Tony's life too. Like, they're all together. They're all going to, they're all either going to jail together or to the firing squad together. As the State Department already relayed to Tony, if anything happens, it's on him. They got nothing. They don't know anything about him. Sorry. No one is here. Goodbye. So, let's see. The six eventually decide that they will trust in the scheme. They are given Canadian passports that Tony smuggles in, brings in, gets from the Canadian minister. And earlier in the movie, we established he has a bit of some handicraft in creating and or forging documents. So Tony has some skill in that area.
Oh, yeah.
And so Tony decides he's going to take them to scouting out in the bazaar so that they can really look around like they're actually looking at sites. But that quickly starts to deteriorate when first they're surrounded in the streets by protesters. And then they end up out in the bazaar. And then there is an angry shopkeeper that takes a dislike to one of the women taking a picture, and that they're Americans, even though they're posing as Canadians. And that escalates some tension right there.
But Tony wanted it to go badly, right?
Did he? Is that your perception?
So, yeah, that was what I was interpreting. Was he wanted to get them out and to get them seen as doing their job to further establish their cover identities, but also they needed a reason to hightail it out of town, and you know, not getting the permit to do the movie, having a bad encounter with some of the locals in public, you know, so being publicly threatened seemed like a good reason to lay the groundwork for wanting to leave the country the next day.
I could see that. That did not occur to me, but that seems reasonable. Again, the moving parts of the plan are amazing. I mean, it's amazingly well thought out and executed. So, love it when a plan comes together, right? A-team style?
Absolutely.
Mendez is told by the Canadian minister, the Canadian ambassador, that everything's off. They're done. There is now a planned military event that will rescue the hostages, and Tony's mission's done. It's over. Forget it. Kaput.
Yeah, they want to call it off because they think it's going to fail and cause an embarrassment and then cause an increase in hostility, which would jeopardize any sort of military action. Very pessimistic.
Yeah. Well, but perhaps not too unrealistic, considering the environment that this all happened in.
Oh, sure.
So basically, Mendez finds out that they pulled the plug on him, including they're not gonna authorize anything in the mission, and they're not going to make sure that the plane tickets are in place, and He's basically told, like, come home, it's done, you're done, forget it.
Yeah, and Mendez knows that the extremists are already circling these six, I'm doing finger quotes here, Canadians, you know, like the housekeeper knows, and is even interrogated by the government official about how long they've been there. So Mendez knows that if he doesn't get them out now, that they're going to be caught and they're going to be executed in public.
As examples. Mm-hmm. And it's not just them. I mean, the Canadian ambassador and his wife and the housekeeper, and it involves more than just the six. I think that adds to the gravity and the immediacy and urgency of the process, is that it's not just these six people. It's anybody who aided these six people. Yeah. And the way the government of Iran was working, or the military arm, or the extremist arm, or whatever you want to classify them as, because there's a lot of debate about the unfair portrayal the Iranians got in this movie, but that's a different topic. But because of all that, they're trying to be very proactive and concerned, because they don't, that if it blows up, it's bad for everyone and we'll get people killed. And the whole point of the mission was to get people out alive.
Yep.
But as it turns out, Tony's pretty much put on hold. He's done. And then Tony decides, nope, I'm doing it. Fuck it. You know what? I came. I said I would do this. I'm going to be responsible. Somebody has to be responsible. Which then you get to see Bryan Cranston. Why can't I remember his character's name? Jack O'Donnell. Sorry. So you see Jack O'Donnell freaking out and doing everything he can then to reestablish the mission, including some pretty good spycraft subterfuge, which, again, the humor in this, where he's, you know, they can't find who they need to find, and he says, we're a spy agency. We should be able to find people. So there's some creative footwork to track down someone who's avoiding his call by posing at his son's school, that there's an emergency with his son, and he finally gets the guy he needs to talk to. And through some pretty tense, situations, the six of them and Tony are now at the airport.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, when they shut down the mission the night before, they shut down the movie studio offices, too, back in Hollywood.
They did. They told him to pull the plug.
Yeah. So John Goodman and Alan Arkin are not manning the phones. They're out commiserating on the failed mission.
One might say they were lollygagging around.
Yeah. Very tense.
It is. This whole movie is a tense movie.
Yeah, especially these last, like, 15 minutes.
Yeah, so they end up at the airport and they're getting through one of the preliminary screenings. And of course, none of them have the correct exit paperwork, because they didn't have any entrance paperwork to have exit paperwork to be carbon copied and filed away. But through some good, again, document forgery and some good coaching from Tony, they managed to kind of get expedited through by some good old-fashioned people manipulation, which is, again, that's good spycraft right there, is what that is, which is kind of impressive.
Yeah, it's basically just staying calm and saying, I don't know what happened to your paperwork.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Reminds me of Cloris Leachman and Mel Brooks in High Anxiety when they're trying to get through the airport metal detector. You just have to act loud and crazy and people will ignore you.
Yeah. Just be confident and people will think they're the ones that are wrong.
If you repeat it enough times, you'll believe it. And if you believe it and can be convincing, people will just
elect you president.
I wasn't going to go quite that far, but that also not far afield. So they have some escalating tension at the airport, because while they make it through the first checkpoint and the first set of obstacles, they come up against a very, very reluctant and animated and not so happy dude who basically doesn't believe them, can't prove anything, but doesn't believe their story, doesn't believe what's going on, doesn't believe that they're Canadian, doesn't believe that they're doing what they say they're doing. He casts a skeptic eye over them and the entire concept of what they're doing. So he decides that he is going to do some research and call the production company. So there is a scramble from him to try and get information. Although I'm not sure why it was a scramble, because they could have just not allowed them on the flight. They could have just detained them, but they didn't. So once he does contact John Chambers at the studio, and John confirms, he goes, yep, no, he's not here. He's, you know, he's on location in Iran trying to get a movie made. Then seemingly the guard lets them go, lets them board the plane. And this is where the tension really ratchets up. This is nuts. Because also in the meantime, it looks like the sweatshop children have managed to get enough of pieces, parts back to recognize people. And they run that right up the chain. And those people pictures match the pictures that were taken of the quote-unquote Canadians from their outing the day before in the bazaar. Mm-hmm. So then it's realized that that's what's happening. And then there's this almost chase kind of feeling where they've got to stop the plane. They've got to stop them from getting on the plane. They've got to stop the plane from taking off. And then eventually they end up on a shuttle bus back to the plane, which is painful, and manual transmission that grinds. That's also painful, and slow, which is also painful. And they end up on a Swissair plane. And they believe that they're good, although none of them really believes they're clear, and they all seem to be pretty nervous, which I think is not an unreasonable. That's not unreasonable considering the situation they're in. So then the plane gets the go ahead, and they get to take off. And in the meantime, the Iranian agent that was trying to get information out of them, that they weren't really who they said they were, realizes that he's been duped. And so they make an attempt to break out of the airport to get at the plane to stop it from taking off.
Very harrowing.
Yeah, but this is also where the movie goes like batshit crazy.
Oh, yeah. There's no way I believe this part actually happened, but it was highly entertaining in a movie.
It was highly entertaining, but they should have been towing a safe down the runway.
I was expecting the jet engines to flip one of the police cars.
Well, that's the thing. First of all, there's no way those vehicles could have been going as fast as the plane taxiing down the runway to take off. Those cars couldn't have kept up, first of all. Second of all, the jet wash of the wake of the sound waves alone would have made it nearly impossible for them to stay that close. It would have either blown the cars off course or would have disrupted some very important things going on mechanically. But again, this is a movie, so I'll try not to be too critical. But they do end up taking off. And as we learned, when Tony came to Iran, when they hit Iranian airspace, no more booze. And so you get that big, nice reveal and relief when it's announced, hey, we can give you booze now because we're out of Iranian airspace.
Yes.
And so they decide, you know, now's the time to celebrate. And I'm sure nobody quite understood on the plane what was going on, but they all kind of come together, and I think they all kind of realize Tony deserves their respect and admiration because he saves them and gets them out.
Yeah.
And then he gets back and they give Tony a CIA star for performance, which of course no one can ever see. So it's yeah, locked away.
It was classified. So
right.
he at first gets excited because he can, if they time it right, if they delay it, he can invite his son to see the ceremony, and he's pretty excited about that. And then Bryan Cranston tells him that it's classified, so he can't ever talk about it. And they're basically just going to show it to him and then take it back. Wah, wah.
Yeah, this it's amazing and sad all in the same. But luckily, when it gets declassified, then he does get his star back. And so, but then the end of the movie is Tony goes home to his wife and his kid, and there is a nearly touching reunion. If I had emotions, it would have been touching, but it was just, you know, merely touching. So, and then that's the end of the movie. That's it. All wrapped up. Kind of nice and neat. With a little bit of knowledge that eventually the hostages do get released to the United States. But also, Mr. Carter, President Carter, does not get reelected, and Reagan comes into office.
No, he gets trounced. And will go down in history as a failure of a president.
Well, he didn't get trounced as bad as Mondale.
Nobody's gotten trounced as bad as Mondale.
Yeah, that was pretty brutal. Even those days, I didn't vote for Mondale. Even though I wasn't a voting age, we voted in social studies class. I didn't even vote for Mondale, so... Nor did I vote for Dukakis, but you know, it's a different time. So, that said, that wraps up the movie. Let me go through my notes. So, my notes are, in 79, the Shah was overthrown, and I remembered that happening. Seeing the embassy under siege, it was amazing to see him recreate the scenes for this, because I didn't realize that almost everything that you saw was recreated. It wasn't... Some of the footage was made to look older than it was,
yeah.
But a lot of that was just recreated. It was amazing, but it was super, super stressful and tense.
Yeah, the end credits were actually really neat because they had their real life photos of not just like the main members of the cast versus their real life counterparts, but also like historical photos of events scenes that he recreated in the movie. And what the actual like photojournalism looked like.
It was nice to see. It was a nice juxtaposition to see how good the art of this movie really was. Let's see. I wrote down this movie had plenty of funny pieces to it, even though it's not a funny movie.
Well, sort of the absurdist humor, right? Like negotiating to buy the rights to the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the whole Argo fuck yourself thing, which yep. I think is hilariously funny, but Lester makes the big point. And like, does it have horses in it? Doesn't matter. If it has horses in it, it's a fucking Western. Like end of sentence. I don't care what you say. It has horses in it. It's going to be a Western. But also they have this discussion, Tony and, Jack and I think the State Department, and they're talking about, well, you know, this is the best bad idea that we've come up with, which is hilariously telling, but also kind of cuts right to the core, because anybody who's ever worked a corporate job with any kind of super important project where you get stuck with some of the bullshit, That's all. That's the best you can do. This is the best bad idea I could come up with. There, you know, it's not a great idea, but it's out of the horrible, terrible things, this one's probably the least worst. It's not a very high bar, but I appreciated it nonetheless. I also wrote that life in the Canadian ambassador's house seems super stifling. I can't imagine having done that for as long as they did. And also, it amazes me that the Iranian government never got suspicious that there was all this food that was going into this place.
Yeah, well, they had their hands full.
Is that playing on your side or my side?
That's over my house.
Okay. The market excursion, the bazaar, was super stressful.
but also had a scene where the fake director was looking through his viewfinder the wrong way.
Which Tony has a pretty witty, witty, snappy one-liner about that. Mm-hmm. About how he's looking at it backwards. I'm going to go out and say that this, to me, is, I think, an A movie. This is excellently acted. It was well cast. It was certainly well written. It was well directed. Visually, it's one of those pretty movies. And even though it's not necessarily a happy, pleasant topic, even though I think some of the group, the Gang of Six, I'm not a fan of all the actors and actresses that made up the Six. Yeah, they were okay, but I think that they had such a strong central supporting cast. Victor Garber, John Goodman, Alan Arkin, Bryan Cranston, Ben Affleck. That was amazing. That was a great cast. And you had some good good smaller roles in here too. So it was nice to see all. It was a good ensemble, as it were. So I think really for me, this was an A movie. So I will pose it to you, Brother Drew. Was it worth it?
Before I answer that, I forgot to ask you in the beginning, what inspired you to put this on the calendar? Was it something that triggered some thoughts about the movie?
It's one of the movies that I own, and I was trying to go through everything that I own that I haven't necessarily watched a lot, but that I remembered either. I'm trying to put everything on the calendar that we haven't discussed and I haven't watched in a long time, and either I hated or I loved. Or the third category, which, I own this and I've watched it and I don't remember if I liked it or not. And I remembered liking this movie, but after rewatching it, I'm like, I remember really liking this movie quite a bit, and watching it again, I'm like, I think I like it even better because I got more out of it this time. I think when I watched it the last time, it was pretty fresh and I wasn't really fully engulfed in the story. And so I was just kind of like following along, but I was a little shell-shocked by, I think, perhaps some of the memories that were attached to it. Because, you know, the hostage crisis was a little bit scary as an 8-year-old. And having a dad who worked for the oil companies, that made things a little scary because we were directly impacted. Although I don't know that we had the full perception of what that meant, but I think we all knew that we were directly impacted by oil embargo. Although I think to varying degrees, I don't think anybody tried to scare us into it. I think it was just the reality of the time that that was just what it was. We were aware. So anyway, my motivation again to put this on the list was that I remembered liking it and I wanted to revisit it. So I'm trying to do that with all of the movies I own. Eventually, pretty shortly here, we're going to run out because I don't own a ton. And then there's just some movies that, you know, we are never going to have on the podcast. I say never, but, by year 10, we will be regrouping. So.
But to answer your question, this movie is definitely worth it. This is a great tight thriller. It's really well made. I think it's really well cast. I like all of them. I like even the Six. I love the 70s-ness of this movie. I love the goofy haircuts and the fashion. It's so well done. Even the smaller roles are still played by people who. Were so great. I mean, we didn't even mention Kyle Chandler. We didn't mention Chris Messina. We didn't mention Titus Welliver. All of them have these small roles, and they're all phenomenal actors who do a great job.
Well, Zelko Ivanek.
Yep. Yeah, he's the one who got his ass handed to him for his bicycle plan.
Yeah.
But yeah, and everybody's kind of overshadowed by Alan Arkin, who seems to be having the most fun of anybody in the movie. And I'm really impressed with Ben Affleck as a director. I mean, we talked about The Town on the podcast, and that's a really solid action heist movie. This is a really solid kind of espionage, historical period thriller. And his first movie, Gone Baby Gone, is I really like that one too. And that's another tense drama. So I haven't seen his latest movie. Is it Color of Night? No, not Color of Night. That was an old Bruce Willis movie. Live by Night, which it was like a, that was another period gangster movie. I haven't seen that one, but after watching this, I'm inspired. I want to go track it down and watch it, because these other three movies have been tremendous.
So Gone Baby Gone, was that the Casey Affleck?
Yes.
So you liked that movie?
I did like that movie.
I did not like that movie. So maybe I'll have to rewatch it. We may have to discuss it. I saw it in the theater opening night.
Oh. I remember being really surprised, because I thought it was going to be kind of a shoot 'em up cop movie, and it was not that.
It wasn't what I expected, and it was tense, but I walked out of it, and I'm like, I didn't like that.
It wasn't tense. It did not have a happy ending. It actually had an ending where you're like, I don't know, man. I don't know what the right answer is.
Maybe that's why I didn't like it. So it may be worth a rewatch, but so especially if you say you liked it as much as you did, then I may have to rethink it. So you may have appropriately influenced me.
Yeah, I mean, Casey Affleck has his own baggage now as being kind of a garbage human being. But he's so good in that movie. Amy Ryan is tremendous in that movie. I mean, she's almost unrecognizable, but she is so good. I mean, you've got Morgan Freeman and Ed Harris in it doing great yeah. work. Yeah. Fun Boston accents. That's always good.
I think the thing that I appreciated about Argo was that even for being 120 minutes long, that movie went by.
It moves.
It was never dull. I mean, there was a lot crammed in there. Mm-hmm. Boyfriend Jesse was very much coveting the cars in the film, because he's like, look at all those great cars. I'm like, well, not all of them were great. So just let me tell you. But the sets were great. But you're right. The costumes, the makeup. Mm-hmm. Their hair, the glasses, the
mustaches.
Yeah, all that. The budget for this movie was approximately $45 million, made $230 million. So it's a pretty good return.
Yeah, I mean, it was a hit. It won Best Movie, right?
Well, Roger Ebert gave it the Best Movie of the Year for that year. His Best Movie for the Year that year. Let's see. Accolades, historical inaccuracies.
Just, come on. It's a movie. Don't tell me that they weren't actually driving down the runway after the plane. I don't want to know. It was a great scene.
I guess Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 96%, which is pretty good.
So it was nominated for and won Best Picture, but Ben Affleck was not nominated for Best Director, even though he won the Golden Globe for it. That's kind of crazy.
Academy Award for Best Film Editing. Academy Award for Best Picture. Got a BAFTA. Academy Award for Best Writing. Let's see. AFI Movie of the Year. Yeah, that's unfortunate. I mean, I think this was... I think most of the performances in this movie were excellent, but again,
Ang Lee won for Life of Pi.
Oh, God, was that the same year? Wow.
I don't know if that holds up. I didn't really like Life of Pi.
I don't believe I've seen it, so.
Alan Arkin was also nominated.
I really like Alan Arkin.
He's great.
I dig him, so. Yeah, so. That wraps up Argo. Do you have any housekeeping?
I do have some. I just got back from San Francisco. That was a really fun trip. We stayed in a hotel that was in Nob Hill. And if you're unfamiliar with San Francisco geography, which I am, or I was, if you are staying in Nob Hill, that means you are essentially pretty much at the top of all of the hilly parts of San Francisco, which is great when you want to go someplace, but when you want to go back, it's rough. It's rough because the hills in San Francisco are extremely steep. But because of that, and because of the location of the hotel, it was right at an intersection of all three of the trolley lines. We actually rode the trolleys quite a bit for actual like transit, not just as like a touristy thing.
So you didn't have to walk uphill?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hills. Lots of hills.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I got no problem with that.
The hills are so steep that going down probably was as taxing on my joints as going back up.
Going down would have been taxing on my heart.
Yeah.
And my sphincter.
And I have little kids, 6 and 7, who thought it was the most fun thing ever to run down these hills. And I was just terrified that they are going to trip and not only shatter all the teeth in their heads, but then continue to roll and glissade all the way into traffic.
Or into the bay.
Yeah, because traffic was also nuts.
Yeah.
And then the streets are very narrow.
Now, did you fly into the San Francisco airport?
Yes, we did.
And did you fly out of the San Francisco airport?
We did.
It's a very strange airport.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed much from what I remember. And I've flown through it a few times recently in the last couple of years, but throughout the years when I've flown through it, I don't think it's ever... LAX is the same way. I don't think it's ever changed. I think things get repaired, but I don't think it's changed. Yeah. It's just a bizarre airport, but the runways are goofy too. Not as bad as Oakland, but if you get fogged in San Francisco, it just sucks. But not bad. I mean,
Yeah, we had decent weather. It rained on us one morning, the morning we went into Chinatown. But so it was still fun.
I saw you got to visit the Fortune Cookie Factory.
Yes, we bought 2 bags of just the fortune cookie discs. So before they shape them into the cookies, so just bags of the rounds essentially, and one of them did not make it back. It's now dust,
pulverized.
Yeah, so maybe it'll be. Topping for some baked goods.
Ice cream topping.
Yeah. But it's fun.
Actually, you know what you could do with it?
What's that?
You could freeze scoops of vanilla ice cream and roll. So you mix the cookie parts with some brown sugar, and then you roll the frozen ice cream ball in it and deep fry it. The deep fried ice cream.
Oh, that sounds intense. I was actually thinking similar lines. I still have a very lovely ice cream maker that you bought me maybe for my wedding.
Possibly.
Or like a birthday or Christmas shortly thereafter. Yes, Cuisinart double ice cream maker. I still have one of those. I was actually thinking about making like a vanilla caramel ice cream and then mixing in the fortune cookie crumbles.
You have the double one?
Yeah.
Oh, two, man. Oh.
2 bowls.
I'm jealous.
Yeah, I hardly ever use it, but I should.
I have a single one. I use it for, I have that peppermint stick ice cream recipe. Mm-hmm. Out of the joy of cooking that is super easy that I love. But I still kept, you remember the Oster ice cream maker we had?
Yes.
That we went through two of. I have the recipe book for that. And so I make.
That was one where you actually had to put in ice, right?
And salt. Yeah.
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 And it works amazing. It works. I have one of them still somewhere around here. It works amazing. It is the loudest thing I have ever experienced. It sounds like a jet engine running in your ear. It is so loud, but it works amazing still. But that recipe book has a recipe for frozen custards. So frozen vanilla custard, frozen chocolate custard. It's amazing. So it works in the Cuisinart thing just as well, but, which I have one of. So you had a good trip.
Yeah, we saw Hamilton as a family, so I took the kids. It was really good, and they sat through it. They enjoyed it. 75% of us cried. so fun was had by all.
Your youngest did not?
She did not.
Yeah.
Yes, she did not. She was... during the second half, she was getting a little restless. She like started to crawl up in my lap and was just having a hard time staying still. And at one point, and the second half of Hamilton is like the really sad emotional part. And so during some of these sad emotional scenes, she turns to me and like at full volume, not like whispering or anything, but like at full volume, she turns to me and she goes, Baba, what is 24 plus 20? I'm like, shh. She's like, yeah, but what's 24 plus 20? I'm like, Emma, you need to be quiet. It's 44. She's like, okay. And that was it.
Wow. It just got stuck in her head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
But, other than that, it was good.
That's hilarious. And adorable.
Yeah, it was just one of those moments as a parent where there's nothing you can do.
No.
There's nothing you can do.
I'll make a good story, though. It already makes a good story.
Yeah.
See, when she's 15, it'll make an even better story.
She won't care.
Oh no, those are the kind of things that come back to haunt you. Trust me, you know this to be true. It's the little it's the little things that you don't realize that come back to haunt you. So,
yeah, she that might work with the older one. She, I think, is her give a shit number is going to be really low. I just don't think she'll care about that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it was a quick trip. We left on a Wednesday and we came back on a Sunday.
And all your pipes are okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We left our garage door closed, so that helped. Although it did snow while we were gone, which is surprising.
Wow.
It didn't stick, but it snowed.
Well, I heard that you guys had the earliest breakup ever. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it stuck.
That's amazing. I mean, terrible, but amazing.
But because I was traveling, I got to watch some movies that I was expecting. I have a question for you.
Sure.
How do you feel about Rocky IV?
I don't remember Rocky IV, so can you refresh my memory as to which one Rocky IV was? I'm sure I have seen it, because I'm pretty sure I've seen... Aren't there five of them?
Do you count the Creed movies as Rocky movies?
No, because I haven't seen those.
Okay. Yeah, so there was Rocky V, and then a few years ago, there was Rocky Balboa.
But Rocky V was still Stallone in the unisphere of the 1 through 4 movies? Was, yes. 5 a continuation? So I've seen 1 through 5.
Yeah. Rocky 5 was the one with Tommy Morrison.
That doesn't mean anything to me. But
Rocky IV was Ivan Drago.
Oh, yeah. Now I remember that one. Because didn't that also have Brigitte Nielsen?
Yes.
Yeah. Now I remember it. I remember enough that I remember him and Brigitte Nielsen. I don't remember anything about the movie. But
yeah. So Rocky IV
I think I'm pretty sure that the three of us saw Rocky IV in the theater together.
Oh, yeah. That's because that's the one where Apollo Creed died.
Oh, yeah.
Killed in the ring by the evil Russian dude. And then I remember crying because Rocky was so upset he threw his motorcycle helmet at Creed's statue. Or maybe at his own statue. There was a statue. I don't know. It was sad. So Creed 2 is like a direct sequel to Rocky 4. And I watched it recently. And I don't know if you've seen either of the Creed movies, but the first Creed was amazing.
I haven't seen it, but it sounds like I'm going to need to watch them.
Oh, you need. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. And Creed 2 is not as good as Creed, but it is a direct sequel to Rocky IV, which is one of the most revered movies from my childhood.
Wow. Okay. Well. I will look into that.
So it was great. And Michael B. Jordan is great.
Yeah, I remember seeing Rocky IV in the theater. I remember seeing Rocky V, but I couldn't tell you anything about it. So
No, Rocky V is terrible and completely forgettable. Rocky IV single-handedly ended the Cold War over the entire globe.
I had an aversion to Creed just because it reminds me so strongly of Scotch Stapp that I have an aversion.
You and I had a text exchange a while ago about great movie trailers. Creed, the first Creed trailer, is one of the best movie trailers because it's just this movie. It's this trailer about Michael B. Jordan, this dude who's like leaving a white collar job to go pursue boxing. And it never says his name, and the trailer goes, and then all of a sudden he's training for a shot at the title, and then you hear this voice, this like kind of like lumbering kind of slow dumb voice, and Rocky steps out of the shadows, and then you get the music, and then you get the reveal that the name of the movie is Creed. It's one of those you lose your mind moments. It's like, oh god, this is so. Creed had a great trailer. Creed was a very good movie. Creed 2 was incredibly enjoyable, not as good a movie.
Nothing wrong with that. So
yeah, but Creed 2 also had a great trailer. It had the first one had a very it used a Kendrick Lamar song DNA extremely effectively. That was good. But also my travels, I got to see a couple movies that I would love to throw on the podcast schedule. Widows. Have you seen Widows?
Can't say that I have.
Widows was good. Bad Times at the El Royale?
Nope.
I think the three of us would enjoy that movie. I also watched a movie called The Brothers Bloom. Have you heard of this one?
Mm-mm.
So The Brothers Bloom is a movie directed by Rian Johnson. And so Rian Johnson directed Brick. He directed Looper. He directed The Last Jedi. I loved all of those movies. So I thought, well, I haven't seen his other movie, The Brothers Bloom. I should watch it. So I got it and I watched it. And as soon as it started, my heart sank.
Oh no.
The very first 2 minutes, I'm like, oh no, this is Rian Johnson doing a Wes Anderson movie. This is going to be terrible. And that's essentially what it is. It's his version of that type of movie. It's got some very whimsical characters. Everybody's kind of a weirdo living in their own world. But as it turns out, his version of a Wes Anderson movie is really good.
Oh.
Like, that's the kind of movie I want to watch. It's got Mark Ruffalo, Adrian Brody, Rachel Weisz in it. Yeah, it's got a Japanese actress. I'm not gonna butcher her name, but she's good. Yeah, I didn't know what to expect from the movie, but that was not it. But it was good. It was an example of what a good Wes Anderson style movie could be if it's not made by Wes Anderson.
Well, I'll keep that in mind.
So I recommend Brothers Bloom, Bad Times at El Royale, Widows, Creed, and Creed 2. Not in that order.
Okay, we will go with that. Any other housekeeping for you?
No, I don't think so. I think it's good.
All right. I have a few stories. First thing, by the time Eric, Brother E, is editing this, maybe, depending on how quickly, his birthday present should have arrived.
Oh, good.
From us, so that'll be good. So teehee, hope he likes it. If he doesn't, then I don't know. Whatever. And great.
Are we allowed to say which birthday he's celebrating?
I think we'll leave that to him.
Okay.
I guess, you know, he's 25 again. But, moved into the new building at work last Friday. A week ago yesterday. Well, oh, I shouldn't nice. Say that. Last Friday, we packed up the old building. Sunday, we moved into the new building, kind of. Spent all day Sunday with the IT people. One of our IT people who had some challenges and didn't quite get everything finished, but Monday we were able to be okay. But we are the first ones to move into this building. It's a big building. It's 9 stories. It's going to hold about 750 people when it's all said and done, in theory. But in the building for the last week, there have been 9 of us. So it's really kind of strange and surreal to be in this big empty building. And slowly people are starting to come over. Tomorrow, which is the 1 week since the actual open, tomorrow it will be a huge influx of people. And the next 2 weekends after that will be the remainder of influx of people moving over the weekends. But one of the things about this new building is, of course, it's green. It's gold LEED certified, or whatever it is, or platinum, or whatever the super spectacular, whatever.
So it has a high sustainability rating.
Very high. Because, of course, it's a government, you know, we're local government. And so we're very big on sustainability. And it's got an eco roof, and it absorbs light, and the heating system, and it uses heat from the outside, and it recycles air and heat, and all these things.
That all sounds very fancy.
You know, it's strange because I worked in a cube farm at Fred's, and now I'm back in a cube farm. So it's kind of like, but I have a nice adjustable desk, which is actually pretty nice. We're a little closer, and there's much, much, much more density and many more people than I've been used to for the last couple of years. So that's going to be a transition. But because of what time I come into work, because I'm in the office by 6:30. Some challenges with the new building is it's further away and there's no parking. So I have to find parking, and that's been a challenge. So I've been leaving even earlier to give myself extra time, and I've overestimated. So of course I end up at work super early, to the tune of like 25 minutes early, which is way too early, but I show up and I'm the first one in the building. And how do I know I'm the first one in the building, except I should say, security is there 24/7. There is a security person, if not 3 of them, in the building at all times, 24/7. But I'm the first. I'm the first actual employee that's non-security in the building at 6:10 in the morning, because every single light in the building is off. So, I go up to my floor and I get off the elevator, and of course it's all secure, so it's badged and controlled, and you can't even get the elevator to the floor without an appropriate badge. And I open the door to my floor, and the entire floor lights up. Every single light comes on. Now, I don't know about you, but in my office, in my other office, because I have two offices, I don't turn the lights on almost ever. Never. Because I have two monitors that I stare at all day long. I don't need the lights on. I have monitors. The lights just add pain and glare for me. So, and I have a window, so there's plenty of light ambiently. So, unless there's an eclipse, which, you know, has happened, or it's super stormy, which has happened, I don't really ever need the lights on. This building, the lights come on. It's motion. So, they just all come on, which would be fine, except there's six of us on my floor right now up until tomorrow. Six of us. An entire floor of a building that's eventually going to have about 100 people on the floor. So I went through the areas that aren't directly where we're at and turned the light switches off, which are these push button controls, which it's all LED lighting and there's dimmers and it turns them off. And
so it does have a switch where you can turn them off.
They do have switches that you can turn them off, but if anybody walks past the area, the motion sensors will turn them back on. So it's this constant thing, because it really offends my sensibility of frugality to have all these lights on for no reason, especially because I grew up with Dad. So I'm used to like turning the lights off. And also I just keep hearing like, we're living in the center of the sun. Like, why is every light on? Like, well, I didn't have any control, because when I come in the floor, every damn light turns on. But I'm on the seventh floor right now. That's where my office is. I shouldn't say office. That's where my desk is. There are no offices.
Oh, that's terrible.
But I've taken the stairs many times this week, which I was okay with until about the fifth floor. And then I'm like, oh God, I have two more floors to go. And then by halfway up between six and seven, I can see the seventh floor door. I'm like, I'm going to die. But then today when I came in, none of the elevators were working.
Oh, so good. You've got some reps under your belt.
Oh my God. So I walk up to my office this morning, and then an IT guy comes in a little later, probably about 5 minutes behind me. And he's like, oh man, the elevators aren't working. I'm like, I know. He's like, did you just walk up seven flights of stairs? And I said, yeah. He goes, me too, man. I said, well, I'm glad we timed it the way we did, because I would have been mortified and I would have had to get off at a different floor if I had heard you, because I would have had to hide my shame. He goes, why is that? I'm like, because I had to stop at floor five and psych myself into going up two more flights at that moment. I had that long, dark moment where I was like, you know, I could just hang out here for a couple minutes and go up when I'm ready. He's like, don't worry about it, man. I had to stop at three. He's skinnier than I am, so I felt a little bit better, I guess. But there's some challenges of the new building. You know, little things like walking down seven flights of stairs in a fire drill is not my idea of a fun time. But they've given us all bowls and plates and glasses at each of our break rooms, which is bizarre to me.
Nice.
We don't have any dishwashers, but okay, that's fine. I guess we'll hand wash everything, except there's no drain racks. And it's weird. It's all from IKEA too. So they're going to be installing some kind of vending process that's like an open vending process where everything's just kind of open, and then you just use a debit card at the end to say what you're buying and semi on your honor system. I don't know how any of that works, so that'll be interesting. But a building full of government employees that, I don't know, we'll see how honest the honor system keeps them. But it's been a thing. You know, but I got to see some of the seismic reinforcements of the building. That's kind of interesting to see the springs and coils and stuff that anchor the building together. So I'll send you a picture of that, because It might look more interesting to you. I don't know what any of it is, but I'm just looked at it and I thought, ooh, that must be important. So
all the stuff that means if you ever experience an earthquake, your building will not stop moving for an extremely long time.
Yeah, they said actually it's very well designed for an earthquake. And I'm like, well, you know, that's what I look for in a building, especially because I'm on the damn seventh floor of a 9-floor building. So, yeah, no, I'm okay with that. The one thing about the building is there's all this technology, which is great. I'm not complaining about technology. They gave us these little boxes at each of our desks that have like two USB plugs and a extension plug so we can plug all our stuff in. Nice. That aren't connected to a computer, that they're just so that you plug your stuff in. Because
just power.
IT security doesn't like us plugging our devices into our computers because that's a whole big security thing. So yeah, so we can just charge stuff directly. But in our conference rooms, they have these giant TVs, which are great. And then there's a little dongle that you can plug into your laptop. That will just send the presentation to the TV. And that's also great, except there's no phones in our conference rooms.
Are you supposed to Skype everything?
I don't know, but, well, except we use WebEx, and like, how do you WebEx or Skype if you, I don't have a laptop?
Oh, no.
So, I'm like, I'm not sure how any of this is supposed to work, so... There's that. And of course, we had a conference call this morning with a WebEx, and I'm like, well, so we actually had to go to my old building, which is going to be decommissioned for us here any day now, and go to my old conference room with the old spider phone and, you know, do a conference. So that was interesting, but growing pains. I shouldn't complain. You know, I've got a nice new working environment in a not so nice part of town. I found parking that's adjacent to the building that's cheaper than where I was parking every day. So that's good.
It's like you're getting a raise.
I'm spending probably 15 more minutes each. Well, 15 more minutes on my way home. So I shouldn't complain. Again, I have a job. I'm fully employed. Blah, blah, blah. But everything is badged. And I haven't been fully authorized for the areas I'm supposed to be in. So it's been a challenge this week because I pushed my badge up to one of the pads and it just doesn't do anything. And I'm like, oh, all right. Okay. I don't need it in here. I'll just, whatever. Also, there's no blinds on the windows. So the sun that shines over my back onto my monitor because my back is to the window is great because I can't see anything when I'm trying to work.
Yeah. You asked me if you assume I might have the same thing about the lights, and I kind of do, except that, you know, I still live in Alaska, and I have a southern-facing window, so it's very binary for me. half the year, I don't turn my lights on, and then half the year, I'm in total blackness, so I have to have my lights on for my entire working day.
Yeah, I really do like my adjustable desk, though. And I actually really, really dig my new office chair. It's actually super, super comfortable. It's the most comfortable chair I've actually ever had. So I'm a little bit jealous that I can only have it at work. I'm sure I could buy one for home, but I'm also sure it's likely super stupid expensive. So it's a Herman Miller office chair. So it's probably going to be like, you know, a gazillion dollars.
Yeah. Office furniture is ridiculously priced.
Yeah, I don't get it, because it seemingly isn't that much more sophisticated than the computer chair I have now. I shouldn't say that. It's not much differently crafted. It's not crafted with much different materials. It's crafted differently because it's designed differently, but like the materials are the same, but it must be the engineering that goes into it because it was expensive. Again, comfortable, and I like it, so which is good. Although today I didn't sit down at all. I stood up the entire day because I have this great adjustable desk, so much more comfortable for me. But anyway, enough about building. Interesting story. I've been having a bit of a trouble with a service that I use online. They're a very large company that you might recognize because they're run by a bald guy. Then, you know, they deliver everywhere and
does
they
it,
have
multiple. Does it rhyme with Schmamazon?
It might indeed.
Okay.
And my quarrel isn't necessarily directly with them, but so I've been having this issue where I, this is so frustrating. So every month-ish, I order these little chewy omega-3 things for my dog because he has, of course, I don't have a normal pet ever. He has skin issues, so he gets these super weird omega chewy things. They basically are meaty Play-Doh, and they're probably only placebo and make me think he's doing better, but he likes them, and so, you know. So anyway, we buy these big tub of them, and they last about a month, and I'm always ordering them, and there's like, they come inexplicably. They come in a 60-count jar, which would last 15 days, or a 150-count jar, which lasts slightly less than 40 days, because 150 divided by 4 and just super irritating. Anyway, it's like, why couldn't you just made a 120? Anyway, so I've ordered these things every month for years now. And I placed an order in mid-March, and between what I ordered and when the order was shipped, somehow they changed what I ordered. Because I have the original order in my email that shows that I ordered the 150 count, but then what they shipped me and what they charged me in the billing item was the 60 count jar. And so I got that and I called customer service and I said, wait a minute, this isn't what I ordered. It is what I paid for, but I wanted the 150. Like, it makes no sense for me to get one for 15 days and have to turn around because the price break wasn't, you know, there's an economy of scale for buying a bigger jar and blah, blah, blah. And so they were, you know, the agent, I called customer service. First of all, it sounded like she was at a party. Because there were like screaming and hollering and hooting in the background of wherever she was. So she was working from home, I would guess, as a call agent, which no problem.
Or they have an open office plan.
Oh, that could be too. So I tried to explain what was going on, and she was like, oh, I'm sorry that happened. So we'll fix it. We'll send out the right thing. We'll refund your thing. You can either keep it or send it back. Like, no big deal. I was like, okay, well, that's fine. Because I'm thinking I'll just give it to somebody at work who has a dog. And so 2 days later, I get the package and it is the 60 count jar. And so I thought, all right, like, whatever. I look at what I get charged. I get charged the lower amount. I get charged the correct amount again. But it's still like, all right, except I gave the first jar away because I didn't think I needed it. And I also, it was free and I could have gotten rid of it. So I have a 60 count jar, which is going to last me exactly 15 days because he gets 4 a day. So I just decide, fine, I will place an order the third time thinking, of course, incorrectly thinking, well, it didn't work the first two times. Surely it will work just fine the third time, right? So I order, and what I got yesterday wasn't even the correct item.
Is this all from the same vendor on Schmamazon?
Yes, yes. It's all from the same vendor. So, and I seriously, because what I got instead of these omegas were multivitamins.
Oh.
So I called customer service and I said, I'm really frustrated. I really need this thing that I'm trying to order. I don't understand why I'm not getting what I'm trying to order. I don't understand how your system changed what I ordered. Cause I would have thought if you changed it, you would have to notify me. Cause I don't know. I'm picky that way. And she just wasn't understanding what I was saying. And so finally I was like, okay, here's my story. And then I'm looking at the item that they sent me, and the item that they sent me has one of those Amazon labels on it that's like clearly from their warehouse pick system. Mm-hmm. And the label on it says exactly what I ordered, but it is clearly mislabeled. So I suspect their system sent me what it thought was the right thing, but it was indeed not the right thing. Which makes me wonder how much of their other stuff is absolutely completely just mislabeled. And then I was thinking, who labels these things? Like, somebody's got to be in charge of quality control, but apparently not.
Skynet.
So, yeah. So, she refunded my money again. They've ordered the item for me anew again. And they're supposed to show up in tomorrow, maybe. Maybe. So, we'll find out next week. If I do indeed get the right damn product, but I was so frustrated, and they had no excuse, offer, or apology really, other than, oh, well, we're sorry. Like, you don't even understand what's going on enough to be sorry. But I did write an email to the vendor and just said, hey, because the Amazon lady said, well, if they get a few more complaints, then they will not be allowed on the marketplace anymore. I'm like, well, I need the product, so maybe not so fast on, you know, screwing them out of the marketplace. But so it's just been a frustrating kind of cycle, because it's clear there's a bit of a language barrier when they call customer service. And again, I don't begrudge the call people their jobs. And like, I couldn't do it for a living, so more power to them. But the fact that their system is designed the way it is, it is nearly impossible to get through to somebody who can actually understand precisely what you're talking about without visual aids. And so I think that was my fault. So next time I'm like, nope, I'm going to use their chat feature instead of the phone call thing, and hopefully I can paste pictures. I think that would have worked better, but like, I don't get it. I usually don't have problems with Shmamazon, but lately it's been like I keep getting these problems. So
that's really funny, because, you know, we've never had problems like that. You see people online complaining about, you know, getting weird stuff from Amazon. That never happened to me, but just the past couple weeks, we ordered some new flip-flops for my daughters. We got them, and the ones for Emma were fine, and then Elle opened up hers. And they were the wrong ones. And she knew what she told us she wanted when she ordered them. And the ones she got were like these Minnie Mouse ones, and she didn't want them. And, you know, it's hard to forget, but that level of disappointment when you're a child and you're expecting something and it turns out not to be what you thought it was going to be. Can be really, really tough. But to her credit, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's because they have so little control about their lives, because uh-huh. they're told when to get up and when to go to bed and when to go to school and what to learn and what to listen and what to do. So that little bit of control is super important. So yeah. when they have control that they can exercise, and then they don't actually get what they're trying to control, that's the worst.
Yeah. And she was actually really cool about it. She, you know, we were like, oh, you know, I'm really sorry this happened. We'll send it back. We'll get the right ones. And she was cool. You know, she was a little bummed that she didn't get her flip flops right away, but she was cool about it. So we did it. We returned them. We said, you sent us the wrong ones. 'Cause we did, we verified the order, and we did order the right ones. And you know, so they gave us all the refund information and sent the right ones out to us. So no big deal. And then we got the second pair. It was waiting for us when we got back from San Francisco. So we tore those open, and they were the same Minnie Mouse flip-flops. And we're like, oh. She was a little less cool about it this time, but it's just really frustrating. There's obviously like, there's a bug in their system. Right. Like you're saying, something is not labeled correctly somewhere. Yes. the AI is going haywire somewhere along the supply chain.
Well, I suspect it's that some human put the wrong label on the wrong product because they either weren't paying attention or aren't paid enough or smart enough to be able to tell the difference.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but at the point that perhaps something gets returned, that should be a clue to somebody that it wasn't a mispick as much as it was mislabeled. So, and I don't know about you, but it was very difficult to get to a human being for me.
Yeah, we haven't even tried the human being route. But yeah, now we're in a situation like, what do we do? We either have to tell her she has to pick a different thing because it's obvious that, you know, the one she wanted either doesn't exist or is so screwed up in their inventory system that will never get to us.
And was it from them? Was it from them directly or was it from a vendor through them?
It was a vendor through them.
And did you contact the vendor?
No, we haven't done that yet. No, we just went through the Amazon process the first time. But yeah, now we have to probably contact the vendor and get this all straightened out.
Yeah.
Which I'm not looking forward to.
I feel your pain. It's super frustrating. Well, I sent the vendor an email with pictures and visual aids. I'm like, here's the jar that I have that's the right size. Here's the jar I got sent that is clearly not the right size. And then here's the third item, which isn't even the right item. So you tell me. But I haven't heard. So.
Yeah, it's just weird. I've never had these problems with Amazon before.
I think as they get bigger, they're going to have these little problems crop up. Because I think they've got, like anything, they've grown so big and so fast that they're hiring. I don't think they're training people as well. They're just kind of giving them minimum training and cutting them loose, which I understand. I've done that. You know, I've had to do that too, but it comes at a cost and it costs customers because it frustrates really badly. But
yeah.
Did you hear about my carbon monoxide problem in the house?
No.
Oh, God.
That sounds troubling.
So we have, first of all, we have a 98% efficient furnace, natural gas furnace, which is weird. It's new from last year, so I'm not used to it because it's modulating. It's a modulating air system, and I don't know if Alaska uses those because I don't know enough about HVAC, but it has a different wave signature when it outputs heat and air, where old forest air systems, like, it would just the pilot light the igniter would ignite the gas and it would start heat and the fan would come on full board. It would just like the whole house would just like fill up suddenly with heat and then bam, the heat's off. And then there was these wave of cold that descends. And then that happens throughout the day. This system kind of alternates, you know, a little bit of heat and then it'll cool a bit and then heat back up and cool and then heat back. So you get this kind of this slow ramp up of heat. And so it apparently lasts longer and also is way more efficient and so supposedly more comfortable. And so we have a Nest thermostat that manages all that and it seems to work out fine, but it's electronic. So there's no pilot light, which is fine. We have instant hot water in the house too. So again, no pilot light. So a couple of things when we went completely efficient is like my gas bill got cut in half. Also because the furnace is like 98% efficient. Our gas bill went from like 75, 80 bucks in the wintertime to like 20 bucks in the wintertime, which is good for us. Although the boys would tell you that I keep the house criminally cold, but,
of course.
So
you are from Alaska.
Well, and I was raised with our father. So, and I lived in the basement forever. So I'm used to the cold in the dark. About 1:30 in the morning, one of the nights, I don't remember, it was a couple weeks ago. And I told Eric this story. The dog is agitated and stirring, and I wake up to the dog agitated and stirring, and I realize that the smoke detector is going off. And I'm like, oh, shit. And I'm trying to figure out which smoke detector it is, and I can't really hear it very well. And the dog doesn't like the noise, and he's freaked out. And I'm like, oh, God. So I got to get up and drag my ass out. I got to go to work in the morning, and I'm just like, not happy. Cranky me. So I go out, and it's not the smoke detector. It's the carbon monoxide detector. So now I'm like, oh, crap, right? And it's plugged in but has a power backup. So okay. I can't see the display, of course, because it's 1:30 in the morning and it's pitch black and it's not in a place where there's a lot of light. And so I unplug it to look at it. And so it's still, by the way, super loud, which I understand. It's an alarm. It's meant to get your ass up. Super loud, hurting my ears, making me close my eyes. It's so loud. So I'm like, oh, shut up. And the dog is just freaked because I'm sure it hurts his ears. And I can't get the battery door open to turn the damn thing off because I don't know why. Probably because it's 1:30 in the morning and it won't stop going off. And so I just turn the light on and I'm looking at the display and I'm trying to read what the display says because I know that there's a chart on the back that says what the errors mean on the front, you know, and it was something about like, you know, if you see 30, that means it's 30 parts per million, whatever, and then get the fuck out. And, you know, if it's zero, then you're fine and blah, blah, blah. So whatever. So I'm trying to get it to turn off. I can't get it to turn off. I can't get it to reset. I'm like, at this point, it's been going off probably for 5 minutes. And so I finally get to read the display and it says end. And I'm like, end? What the fuck does end mean? Like, end? Like, I don't understand. So finally, like
your life is going to end because you're about to be poisoned with carbon monoxide.
So I take my meat tenderizing mallet and smash the back of the machine open so that I can get the battery out of it. Except it's a 9-volt battery and it has that little 2-prongy thing that the 9-volt attaches to. And the battery's been in it so long, it's like spot weld corroded to it, and I can't get it to come apart. So I can't get the fucking battery off of this thing that won't stop screaming at 1:30 in the morning. Finally, I ratchet loose the thing and it goes out. And I'm like, oh, thank God. And then I finally see on the little chart back there, this is end. End means end of life. You need a new detector.
Are you the only one in the house?
No.
Everybody else is just sleeping through it?
Yes.
So not only are you frustrated, but now you're mad at everybody else for being able to sleep through this nonsense.
No, I'm like, I told Jesse and Derek both, I'm like, you both are dead. Like, you both are dead. I and the dog are the only ones that lived. You both died. And Jesse was right next to me when I heard it. So it's not like he couldn't have heard it. He just didn't. And the detector was actually closest to Derek's bedroom by, oh, I don't know, 20 feet closer to his bedroom than mine. So he didn't hear it at all. So I'm like, well, I'm glad we got a detector that I'm the only, well, the dog. The dog and I are the only ones that managed to hear or respond to. So long story short, too long, I know. I didn't know they expired. I didn't know that they had a consumable that would wear out that would need replacement. I mean, I guess it makes sense, but there's no carbon monoxide problem in the house. It's just that the machine, you know, it was like, oh, time to die. And rather than, you know, the smoke detectors that will chirp every now and then when their battery's low, you know, this motherfucker decided it was just going to scream until somebody responded, which is what I would expect if there was carbon monoxide, but not when the machine was no longer functioning. I bought a 3-pack of the little Nest smoke detector carbon monoxide things and installed those, one in the hallway, one in the living room, and then one in the basement by all of the natural gas sources in the house. So that was interesting because the little 3-pack came together and actually went together pretty well. It was pretty slick. Apparently because I have the Nest thermostat that couples it together. If it senses carbon monoxide, it will turn the furnace off.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, that's a nice little feature, but I was kind of impressed by it because it went together really quick and, you know, you get that little the little nightly green thing that tells me that it's on, these little passive night lights that come on. So I don't know. I'm kind of enjoying technology now. Also the fact that I don't think the thing's going to goddamn scream at me for no reason. So,
well, yeah, it'll, we've got Nest Protects in our house. Yeah, what I like about them, it's really good for kids, is it's got the verbal alarms to tell you what's going on.
Oh.
You know, it says it also, you can manually shut it off from your phone.
I guess you can shut it off by waving at it too.
Yeah, like if you're cooking something smoky, it'll, you know, say smoke detected in living room. And then it actually gives you a few seconds to go on your phone and you can kill it before the alarm sounds. So it's super handy. But
I haven't experienced that yet. Yeah. But
no, it's, yeah. I really like them. And when they do their monthly checks, you know, they automatically cycle through all the alarms and make sure all the sensors are still working properly. And
oh, they do that?
Yeah, so you can actually set it up to do it like at a time during a weekday in the middle of the day when nobody's supposed to be home or whenever you want. But if you're not home, you know, you can actually check to see when, you know, what happened during the last check and make sure everything's okay, which you don't even have to do because it gives you the green light every night when you shut off your lights, which is great.
I've seen that. So I didn't know it auto tested. So
yeah,
that'll be a thing. Interesting. When we first moved into this house, there were smoke detectors in virtually every room. The problem was, however, that they put a smoke detector directly over the edge of where, on the floor opposite the ceiling of where this is mounted, the oven door opens completely out. So anytime I would preheat the oven and open it, this plume of heat and smoke, you know, not a lot of smoke, but you know, you always have sometimes a little bit of residual, would go right into this thing and just set it off. And because they are all paired together,
yeah,
the old smoke, the whole system would go off. And it'd be like, all right. So finally, this is not a sustainable thing. Like, this, I understand why they have it, because it's the law that they had one, I'm sure, in every room of the house, but because we were renting initially and all that business. But I'm like, no, this is not, like, no, like, not happening. Like, I will put them everywhere else in the house, but not over the damn oven door. So, but I guess the nice thing about the new ones is they're not really affected by steam, although I don't have one in the bathroom, so I'm not sure. But I guess they're supposedly smart, and they'll last for 10 years, so we'll see. I don't know how long they really will last, because it seems to me every time I see them, the little nightlight thing's on. So,
yeah, I've got a first-generation model in one of my rooms, so it's probably, what, 6 years old now?
Did you get battery ones or wired ones?
They are wired.
Yeah, I just got the battery ones, and the batteries can be replaced. Although, again, you know, the carbon monoxide element of them apparently has a consumable, so God knows.
Yeah.
But they said, well, I don't know, you have the first generation. I have the newest ones.
Yeah, I've got the newer ones in most of my rooms.
So they were 10 years, as they say.
Yeah, they're nice. I like them. I like Nest stuff. It's all easy.
Yeah. Well, and I got a free Google Home Mini thing with my, because I bought a 3-pack. So
nice.
I don't know what I'm going to do with it, because I already have one and I don't use the one I have. So now I have two, and I'm like, I don't know.
Just leave it out so it can listen to everything you do.
It's a little freaky sometimes. I always forget I have it. And then I'll remember, oh, I should ask it things. But ask it things, it's like, I do not understand. Like, you're stupid.
It's just trying to get you to talk more.
Angry. I'm angry at technology that was free. Like, million-dollar technology that we take for granted. So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here. Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies, so they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the Brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away unless you're driving. Keep them open in that case. We got Aaron, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey. Not in a creepy way. 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 Okay. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Okay.